You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Stephen Pfeiffer. I am a senior fellow here at Brookings, where I direct the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative. And it's my pleasure to welcome you all to this event, which is being co-sponsored by the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative and the Heinrich Böll Foundation. And we're very grateful for the foundation's support for the event. We're also grateful for the support of Plowshares and the Carnegie Corporation for the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative here at Brookings. What we want to do today, first of all, is release a paper, which I hope you received when you came in. It's on the future of arms control that was prepared by the Heinrich Böll Foundation. And this paper comes out of a workshop that was held last September in Berlin to look at a range of issues related to both arms control and proliferation, both the opportunities, but also some of the challenges, some of the things that might hold up arms control. And you have on the panel here four people, each of whom contributed a piece to this this paper. And what we're going to look at today are, what are the challenges to arms control? What sorts of issues out there might make it more difficult, for example, to move beyond the New START treaty for further reductions of strategic nuclear weapons, or to get into a dialogue that might lead to constraints or even reductions of non-strategic or tactical nuclear weapons? And when you look at those challenges, they're both technical and political issues. Certainly the technical issues were there even a couple of years ago. It was fairly obvious that progress on further nuclear reductions was going to require at least some kind of meeting of the minds between Washington and the West and Russia on issues such as missile defense. The Russians have expressed concern about prompt global strike. And another question is the absence of a conventional armed forces, arms control regime in Europe. So those are the sorts of issues that have been linked in the past to further nuclear reductions that I think we all understood were going to be issues that had to be addressed, if not before, then at least in parallel with the question of further nuclear cuts, if you're going to make much progress on that. But over the last several months, we've seen a different issue arise. It's more of a political issue, and that's the challenge of how do you move forward on arms control when you have what looks to be a fairly significant downturn in U.S.-Russian and European-Russian relations due to the events in Ukraine and the Russian response to those events. And what you have, I think, is a situation that has complicated the broader political atmosphere around arms control, which on the one hand makes it much more difficult to do arms control. Some of the ideas that we talk about in this book, you know, may not get quite the hearing that they would in Washington that they might have received, say, 3 or 4 months ago. But on the other hand, I think this crisis demonstrates the value of arms control. I mean, it's, I think, useful and reassuring in the West and probably also in some quarters in Moscow that as we head into a more difficult period in relations between the West and Russia, there are the bounds of the New START treaty on strategic nuclear weapons. There's the predictability, there's the transparency that that agreement provides. But we've got a group here, we've decided that we'll focus today on what are those challenges that might inhibit further nuclear reductions. And we've got a very good panel with a Russian, or somebody representing a Russian viewpoint, an American viewpoint, and a German viewpoint. So our first speaker is going to be Nikolai Sokov. He's now a senior fellow at the Vienna Center for Disarmament and Nonproliferation. And he'll describe some of these issues as he sees the Russian perception. Our second speaker is Dennis Gormley, who's at the University of Pittsburgh. And he'll discuss some of the technical questions that might impede further nuclear reductions. And then finally, our third speaker is Gertz Neudeck from the University of Hamburg, and he'll talk about a European perspective on these questions. And then after that discussion, after some discussion among ourselves, we'll then be happy to open up the floor to questions from the audience. So Nikolai, why don't you get us started?
Yes, thank you, Steve. you can hear me, right? No. How does it work? Oh, now you probably do. Good. Well, it's a pleasure and an honor to be here. Yes, and thank you, Steve, for inviting me to this panel. When Steve actually asked me kind of to speak on these things and said what he wants me to discuss, I thought, oh my God, that's really not interesting. But I'm forced to, I'm sorry. Oh, yes, and one kind of thing that I should say from the very start, you already probably guessed, yes, I stutter. Yes, I stuttered my whole life. When I became like a student back 40-plus like years ago, 45, whatever, like years ago. Yes, I decided that I should like overcome that and force myself to speak at every seminar. Yes, and I have not been able to stop since. So please, Steve, please stop me when I'm out of time. So anyway, the dialogue like on nuclear arms reductions, on control, whatever, has been actually stalled for like about 10 years, maybe slightly more than 10 years. So look, in this sense, nothing has, nothing very interesting has happened. The reset has, of course, helped. The reset changed the atmosphere. The reset made possible the New START, which is a very nice treaty, very useful treaty, but nothing really too dramatic, to be honest. The New START did the most important job at this moment back in 2010 to restore the verification transparency regime. Yes, and that that was really needed. That was done, but that's fundamentally it. The bottom line's been like about the same for about 10 years, I already said. The United States has really concentrated primarily on nuclear weapons, trying to reduce nuclear weapons. Yes, and Russia has developed by about 2005, although the elements had been there before, the so-called integrative approach to arms control that includes almost everything. First and foremost, missile defense, conventional strike weapons, and things like that. That contradiction has not really been resolved for a long time, and that's why we have a standstill. We always have known that it takes two to tango. So I would say that one of the biggest challenges that we face now, well, sometimes, it doesn't make sense to tango if you don't have a partner, right? Doing that alone is strange. But it's next to impossible to tango if you got more than two partners. Yes, and what we actually seen like in the last 10 years, maybe even longer, was an attempt to tango with three partners. Yes, and the third was Congress. Yes, and of course, you're bound to step like on someone's foot. Absolutely. What happened, the big change, especially like on the U.S. side compared to the Cold War, has been a very close involvement on Congress in arms control. Instead of oversight, Congress has really defined a few very like important lines, a few elements in the U.S. position, including, no discussion or at least no concessions on missile defense, on conventional weapons. Isn't that really kind of doomed the possibility of exploring quietly new kind of options and trade-offs? Since the line have been really cast like in stone on both sides, we don't go anywhere. Just a few really words on missile defense. It's been a very familiar situation for 30 years, actually. Since the SDI, the missile defense system that might emerge in the future was always kind of causing a stalemate on the reduction side. That was the case in the 80s. That was really overcome by concession from the Soviet Union. To some extent, that was the case in the 90s. Yes, and that's been the case since roughly 2001. On tactical nuclear weapons, same thing. Nothing is really going. Frankly, I do not see a lot of role for tactical nuclear weapons in the Russian nuclear strategy. At least not in Europe, but going ahead, forging a new treaty, doesn't really work, because you really need a whole new concept of a treaty. You need to shift from delivery vehicles to warheads. That's new facilities open for verification. Russia is very reluctant to do that. So that's done too. And Russia just invented a really convenient pretext, the demand for the United States to withdraw the remaining B-61 bombs from Europe. Yes, and that's just a pretext, really. Yes, and to be honest, the NATO members then that want to keep some of them, like in Europe, really play into the Russian hands, in my view. So everyone's happy, really. Nothing's happening, yes, everyone's happy. So yes, in this sense, the crisis over Ukraine does not really change much. The crisis in Ukraine simply brings forward the same things that we've seen before. It certainly changes the atmosphere to the negative, but the atmosphere was actually quite bad like before that crisis as well, if you talk about arms control. The administration has stopped the process like of regular consultations, but I think that process will resume maybe like in the fall or something. But once again, it's the substance of the positions of the two parties that prevents progress. Now let me turn to the stuff that I really find interesting. And that's of conventional weapons, conventional strike and defense weapons. And my contribution to that volume is precisely about the conventional strike and defense weapons. These weapons. Like as I already mentioned, that's actually one of the things that the Russians want right now. They want to include them into the dialogue. Yes, and of course, the United States is very, very limited on what could be done on that. At the moment, that just contributes to the deadlock. I think that the deadlock that we see today will not last forever. Like it never happened before. And at some point, the situation will change. And I think that the driver for this change will be the efforts of the Russian side to develop a modern conventional strike and defense capability similar to what the United States has. The effort's been underway for more than 10 years, and most people just conveniently waved away, saying that Russians will never be able to do that. He's pointing out especially at the 2008 war in Georgia, where the performance of Russian troops was not very stellar, let's put it like that. But it's important to keep in mind that after that war, after 2008, investment into conventional strike, especially capability, has increased dramatically. That late last year, in a series of meetings in late November and early December, Putin actually spoke openly about the Russian intention to develop the prompt global strike capability. To me, frankly, yes, I've been actually following Russian developments for a long time, of course. To me, this actually means that he does, well, that the government, the military, the defense industry actually see the effort succeeding in the future. They would not have gone public unless they really sure they'll succeed. The question is when. If you follow key capabilities, the technological gap between the United States and Russia used to be 10 to 15 years, like around the year 2000. Now the technological gap, well, I think is down to 3 to 5 years. On PGS, on prompt global strike, actually the two sides start at the same time, roughly. But since the Russians actually plan to emphasize the ICBM technology that they know extremely well, they've excelled in it for decades. I think they have very good chance at getting PGS capability soon. So my hunch is that in 5 to 7 years, we might actually see an operational conventional strike capability in Russia. The missile defense capability in Russia is much better actually known, but I think we speak about roughly the same time horizon. What is going to change? This is going to change a lot. Well, it seems to me that it will come as a surprise, as it always does. The same dynamic that we saw with transition from SALT 1 to SALT 2 when the Soviets suddenly acquired the Merving technology that apparently few in Washington thought that they could master. Is I think that Washington today is possessed with the same kind of idea that monopoly on modern conventional capability will exist forever just because no one else can do that. Yes, I think that's not exactly a very wise attitude. So what we're going to have is... conventional capability, the modern conventional capability that we've seen since Gulf One did a very important thing. It introduced military power back into foreign policy. Nuclear weapons cannot be used. They're just so horrible. The traditional armies could not be used. The last time the United States used it was Vietnam. Last time the Russians used it was in Afghanistan, right? You cannot use it. So for some time in about 70s, 80s, military power was almost absent from international relations. Starting with the Gulf One, that capability once again emerged, but only like on one side. Just try to imagine what happens when one more country, and Russia specifically, can actually be more proactive in foreign policy and is capable of supporting its foreign policy with military force when necessary. When tanks don't have to roll, yes, and you don't have to send a polite green man somewhere, like it happened in Crimea, you can actually do the strikes from your own territory. Because for Russia, the main theaters of cooperation are actually just across the border. It's not, in fact, Europe, I believe, that they're looking at primarily, but to the south. Oh, Afghanistan, oh, Middle East, yes, places like that. So yes, that's what we're going to, I think, see, and we're just not prepared for that. So the consequences for arms control, yes, I'm actually wrapping up. Two consequences for arms control, yes, and this is not one or another, it's actually both. The first is that the Russians will say, well, we will not negotiate now. We finally got that capability, and why should we actually negotiate it away? Yes, on the other hand, like in Washington, people will probably see that we actually need to do some arms control. So I think like in 5 to 7 years, it'll be too late. Once again, yes, I just refer you back the Merving kind of challenge back in the 70s, yes, and the result of this conviction that we should not actually put Merv on the table was a very convoluted arrangement in SALT 2 that took years and years to develop. The second consequence, I think, will be NATO. Yes, NATO strategy right now is based on an appropriate mix of nuclear conventional Western defense. And I suspect that some members of the alliance might actually want to change that mix. Because when they do not have to fear Russian tanks rolling, but instead that Russia will be able to do actual strikes without immediate contact, physical contact, they might feel very concerned. And might, in fact, want NATO to emphasize nuclear weapons more than is the case today. To conclude, yes, I really think that the concept that underlies that book that we discussed today, the concept of preventive arms control, is a very good concept. I'm a strong believer. I think that we should actually try to preemptively deal with that issue, as I'm just a bit skeptical on the political dimension of that. For some proposals that I have, yes, I have to refer you to the book itself, in hopes that you'll actually read it. Thank you.
Thank you. Dennis.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to talk about an issue that bears some relationship to the comments you've just heard. It has to do with some of the barriers to deeper reductions in nuclear weapons that stem from the emphasis that's been given in U.S. military developments, essentially beginning in the first Gulf War and manifesting itself strongly in the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review, where strategic stability was a featured commentary mentioned 29 times in the document itself, and featured to emphasize the extent to which the willingness of the United States to achieve deep reductions in nuclear weapons was dependent on growth in its capacity to use precise conventional delivery systems to achieve very precise effects. So, and that was cast in the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review as the U.S. achieving an unrivaled growth in American conventional weapons superiority, which, of course, thought of in the context of how that might resonate in places like Moscow and Beijing, raises a different set of issues that and challenges for the United States to somehow square this dilemma, where you might be at once scaring the living daylights out of your those states that you wish to travel the same path toward deeper reductions in nuclear weapons. So the challenge, it seems to me, is how do we not give away our hard-earned advantage in conventional capability, but at the same time allay concerns in places like Moscow and Beijing initially? There, I want to focus on conventional prompt global strike, but I would also strongly point out the importance of recognizing that Russia in particular, and to some extent China, are enormously concerned about the growth in precise delivery systems surrounding filling, for example, Ohio-class submarines with large quantities of advanced Tomahawk cruise missiles and getting very close to Russian territory and being in a position to improve those delivery systems so that they can penetrate even silo caps. So let me talk about conventional prompt global strike, and very, very briefly. There, for those of you not familiar with it, there are three current systems. The first, the United States Air Force's a conventional strike missile, which commenced in 2008 after the demise of an attempt to place conventional warheads on the Trident submarine, which created a firestorm of debate about being able to determine whether it was carrying a nuclear or a conventional round. The conventional strike missile employs a whole host of glide technologies. It has huge cross-range capability and maneuverability in space, together with great accuracy. Of course, this is on a set of slides. The conventional strike missile has not yet had a successful hypersonic flight, and its original intention to be in a position to deploy a very small number, a niche capability, by 2012 is obviously past. So it remains to be seen whether it meets its desired objectives. The second is an even more ambitious program called the Hypersonic Test Vehicle 2, and it is funded by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, and it is intended to travel at 13,000 miles per hour right along the upper atmosphere of space, and it thus far has had very modest results. It has yet to sustain aerodynamic control over an extended period of time, no less for the full mission range of the system. And as a consequence, its budget has been cut severely, down to $2 million for the 2014 budget. The third and most successful, but with limited capabilities by comparison to the theoretical capabilities of the other two systems, is the U.S. Army's Advanced Hypersonic Weapon, which has achieved in one successful test a range of 2,400 miles. This would impose on the U.S. the requirement to consider forward basing for it, which is not the preference for truly prompt conventional strike systems from the continental United States. But it is a successfully so far, but several other tests have to occur to before any system is ever deployed. So together, these systems represent not much to write home about, but remain objective systems with an intent to deploy a niche capability for whatever system can be made to work successfully. I have a much longer piece for those of you interested in the German security journals, Security and Peace, that just came out. It's the volume one of the 2014 edition of this journal. If anyone is interested in looking at it, it's a lengthy paper that looks at the risks and benefits of conventional prompt global strike. I have a few copies that I could send to folks, so talk to me later on if you're interested. I'll come out squarely and say my conclusion in the piece is that I believe the risks clearly out are more prominent than the benefits of deploying conventional prompt global strike for a variety of different reasons. And when people talk about a niche capability, they're talking about numbers in the area of 20 missiles. But if you look at the provenance of the conventional prompt global strike system, you see that much more fulsome capabilities were in the minds of some of the original planners of this, dating back to the mid to late 1990s, where they saw a large-scale transformation of heretofore nuclear intercontinental ballistic missiles to conventionally oriented systems. So there is always that danger in the mind of our companion countries that are achieving deep reductions, that these systems will be turned into a more fulsome capability by some future administration. So what are the chief risks? I'll talk about those. The dangers are meager, and frankly, I won't bother on articulating any of those. But the dangers, it seems to me, are the first the creation of strong preemptive incentives on the part of states, certainly in the gun sites of these systems, and even those states wishing to emulate U.S. developments. And it comes in strange packages. Japan, for example, has talked about the need for a long-range prompt strike system that can deal with emerging problems like challenges to the islands in the region. And if you look at all of the huge outbreak of countries interested in preemptive strike systems in Northeast Asia, the addition of Japan is a toxic mix to that already explosive outbreak of the proliferation of missile technology in that region. But it seems to me the true Achilles heel of conventional prompt global strike is the notion of planning an attack within a 60-minute time frame that greatly depends on an unprecedented capacity by the intelligence community to provide highly accurate intelligence and correct intelligence about what the target is truly up to and whether it merits the kind of attack that may engender unwanted consequences. And I think that is really the long pole in the tent when it comes to this concept. So moving on, let's assume that conventional prompt global strike systems in a niche capability are deployed. What implications does that have for future counting rules? I argue in my paper that we must be willing to accept counting rules, not just for existing missile types, ballistic missiles that might be armed in the future with conventional warheads, but for those of the so-called new types, which under New START are not counted as potential delivery systems. And these have to be added. This would include boost glide, and even, in my view, hypersonic systems ought to be included in future counting rules if we reach that point. Now, let me end on a couple of points that I guess I would characterize as part of a concern that I have for the unintended consequences, without looking closely at all of the ramifications of a deployment of this kind of capability without serious attention to these unintended consequences. And it seems to me that the first one is really oriented around the necessity for both the U.S. And Russia in particular initially to achieve deeper reductions is going to require the kind of dialogue and transparency that is absolutely unprecedented in the history of arms control, in my view. And to achieve progress, the parties, it is essential for the parties to abstain from the kind of exaggeration that tends to occur and appreciate the distinction between what is hypothetically possible in these scenarios and what is realistically achievable when evaluating these threats. The second thing is the unintended consequences with respect to arming heretofore exclusively nuclear missiles and then adding new classes of capability, boost glide and hypersonic, with conventional warheads in an era when we have, I would argue, made enormous headway in constraining the proliferation of nuclear-armed ballistic missiles. And in the treatment that the missile technology control regime has given to nuclear-oriented ballistic missiles, has had achieved considerable success, I would argue. Now, you add conventional warheads to these systems and furnish them with this perceived utility, and you start seeing an activities along the lines of MTCR states, other MTCR states, embracing, if not boost glide systems, but conventional, long-range conventional missiles in a role not unlike conventional prompt global strike. So you could open Pandora's box by going down this path without careful consideration for the ramifications of taking these actions that might redound to our disadvantage in terms of incentivizing states to pursue conventionally armed long-range missiles of a variety of different sorts. I mentioned Japan's example before, but there are many others that I could add to that. And the last comment I'll make is really a concern about the penchant for the United States, and this is a penchant that is on display throughout its history. You know, we're a history our history is an illustration of the engineering prowess of the United States as a society to build great highways across the American continent. We do not have a corresponding history of elegant consideration of strategy. And I would say that the notion of conventional prompt global strike suggests this tendency to dabble in this very appealing technological example of what can be done with missile technology, rather than concentrating on all of the unintended consequences of going down that path. So I would urge us to be very careful, particularly the U.S. government, in examining this system in a truly holistic way before we proceed down that path. Thank you.
Thank you. Oops.
Yes. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? No. Yes. Okay. So, of course, at the outset, let me thank first Stephen Pfeiffer and also Charlotte Beck and the Heinrich Böll Foundation for inviting us for this event. It's, of course, a privilege to be here and to discuss the topic of this brochure, which is the future of arms control in critical times. As a European or as a German, I should sit between the Americans and the Russians, but I'm sitting a little bit outside here. Which is no problem for me, because the first part of my presentation would be highly political. I'm a physicist, and I'm happy to challenge Nikolai on technical subjects, and I fully agree with the cautious words of Dennis Gormley about solving deeply political problems by technological means. This never worked quite well and caused a lot of trouble and turmoil. So the book, I think, is a good opportunity here to deepen the Euro-Atlantic transatlantic dialogue on arms control and non-proliferation. And I think you should have a look in it. It has four chapters, one of how to deal with new approaches of arms control. Do we need new approaches? We live in the 21st century, and it's no longer the parity-based, symmetry-based arms control, which works quite well. There are new instruments and institutions available. Then the second is what we talked about, much more technological developments. Technological developments always pushed arms control in some kind of corners. So technology sometimes was developed, and later on the people started thinking what to do with that strategically and also politically. And then there is also a chapter on drone warfare. I think this is a subject which is, I think, much more relevant than prompt global strike, which is clearly a niche capability. And of course, I'm a little bit surprised to learn that our Russian friend here, which I know since a long time, is now a brave pundit of Ronald Rumsfeld. by observing that Mr. Putin also wants to go in that direction. I only can say good luck with that. I think in the first chapter, Alison Bales from the UK explains that the classical treaty method of defining arms restraint are unsuited to reach non-state actors. Instead, actions to block supplies to maverick states and violent non-state actors ranging from embargoes, sanctions, and regulation negotiated at the UN are certainly necessary. Nevertheless, the treaty method has not been, I think, extinguished. As the Arms Trade Treaty shows, Alison Bales also writes that we should also have in mind that new export moves by hard-pressed defense producers and an increased temptation to rely on relatively cheap nuclear weapons as well as conventional weapons are shifting balances in some regions. So I agree with Dennis that we should have first defined the strategic goal and then we should discuss about the weapons, not the other way around, accepting some kind of technological fix here and after deployment thinking what that means. And I think there are not only examples in the Euro-Atlantic context, but there are also examples in the Middle East and South and North Asia here. Des Brown, former Secretary of State of Defense, in his contributions points out that the business of the Cold War and the legacy of mistrust is unfinished. The business is simply unfinished, and he proposes to multilateralize the START talks within the P5. Others are arguing for a renewed multilateral, multi-level system of arms control and disarmament based on equal rights and equal binding rules of old and new powers. So I think it is always useful on a very conceptual basis to talk about new approaches. Nikolai mentioned preemptive arms control. We called that 10 years ago preventive arms control because preemptive already means that the systems are deployed and that we need for crisis management purpose some kind of red telephones. I think that's not the right approach. The right approach is to prohibit specific destabilizing technologies. And obviously, from the Russian side, this is unheard. The topic of the session here is further nuclear disarmament, and I think we didn't speak much about that. So let me allude a little bit on that. You, of course, know that President Obama has proposed a one-third cut in the New START limit on deployed strategic warheads, which was never answered constructively by Mr. Putin. To many unsolved areas such as ballistic missile defense and prompt global strikes, NATO nuclear policy, especially tactical nuclear weapons, and the military superiority of conventional forces. These are major obstacles for deep cuts. There is no doubt that the whole package causes a lot of problems. And unfortunately, the American side never understood that these sometimes hyped technical developments are a major excuse and a major factor in the Russian perception. Unfortunately, the Europeans also were never capable to balance Russian imperial ambitions and never found ways to transform the European security architecture based on their own European interest in a functioning European security system. I think this is the major problem and the major sin of European security policy. Despite the current crisis, most of the Europeans think that existing nuclear arsenals of the Russian Federation and the U.S. are simply too high. The U.S. and Russia possess a nuclear arsenal deployed and non-deployed, strategic as well as non-strategic, that by far exceed reasonable deterrence requirements. Both countries need to organize a more energetic dialogue to find new ways for predictable and verifiable strategic stability setting at low numbers. And currently in our discussion, we will see whether low numbers are possible any longer or not, depending on the crisis over the Ukraine. If we look to numbers, then I think the U.S. is still planning with 700 deployed strategic nuclear delivery systems, 500 ICBMs, 240 sea-launched ballistic missiles, 60 bombers. Russia is already well below the 700 deployed delivery systems limit, with 473 nuclear delivery systems. The U.S. has around 809. So we have actually a different asymmetry here. In principle, it is not so complicated to accelerate the New START reductions even beyond 1,550 warhead level to convince the Russians not to invest in nuclear force modernization. I think this is also unheard by the Russians. Unfortunately, the crisis over the Ukraine delays another formal bilateral nuclear agreement. I think most of the European countries are very much interested in such an agreement. We, of course, have also to speak about tactical nuclear weapons. And I think an exchange of data on the numbers, location, status is overdue, as well as a dialogue on nuclear doctrines and stability. Cooperation about ballistic missile defense seems actually far away. But given the limited performance of the current BMD systems, a data exchange and the creation of BMD cooperation centers is still a possibility. The Russians also are not interested in that. The capabilities actually are very, very limited. And I speak here as a physicist. The interceptors cannot reach under any circumstances Russian ICBMs heading to the United States. And it's simply an excuse by Russia to say that BMD, the current BMD architecture in Europe, is a problem for strategic forces. Either they don't understand physics and geography, or they are still in their ideological mood. And after the breakdown of the dialogue between Europe and Russia, I fear we are in the last row of the debate. Let me speak a little bit about the Ukraine crisis and its impact on arms control. Throughout history, it becomes clear that the U.S.-Russian arms control advances are highly dependent on the political climate between the two countries. The crisis over Crimea and the Ukraine, which is far to be over, might become a long-lasting stumbling block for any progress in the field of arms control. On the contrary, there is a danger of further escalation. Some voices in Europe are demanding military reactions, such as regular maneuvers, forward permanent deployment of NATO troops and equipment, of course, strengthening ballistic missile defense systems in Central East European countries for deterrence purposes. Others are articulating increased modernization and rearmament of NATO's military forces and withdrawing NATO's proposal for a BMD cooperation with Russia. NATO representatives are arguing that NATO might face a new adversary to our east. And if Russia is going in that direction, then we would have a lot of problems, I'm sure, not only the U.S., but also the European countries. So I think such a development is not in the interest of anybody. It has huge financial, cultural, and other ramifications. As long as the crisis is not over and a robust arrangement of the integrity and economical stability of the Ukraine has not been found, the long-term consequences of Russia's annexion are unclear. Nevertheless, we should have in mind that the OSCE procedures, which are a result, by the way, of the Cold War, are still working. The conflict prevention mechanism, the Vienna document, the Open Skies Treaty helped to calm down the unclear information gaps by improving transparency and predictability. It is obvious that such instruments can play a de-escalating role. And I hope this at the end should also turn Russia back on a reasonable discussion about the future of European security. We should also have in mind that the Europeans benefited heavily from arms control agreements at the end of the Cold War. Simply mentioning the INF Treaty, the CFE Treaty, and the Open Skies Treaty, although all are in danger, and they are even more in danger if that comes true, what Nikolai already mentioned, that would be certainly the breakdown if prompt global strikes, long-range accurate systems are developed and deployed in Russia, then this is certainly the end of the INF treaty. We should also understand that the breakup of the Soviet Union caused a lot of problems which not have been yet articulated or so far be solved. When the Soviet Union shrinked and became Russia, it lost, and that I think these are important figures, not to speak all the time about nuclear warheads and tactical nuclear weapons, but the population shrink by one sixth, which are 25 million. And the Soviet Union or Russia owned a lot of frozen conflicts, mainly in Central Asia. 12 former Warsaw Pact countries became NATO members and changed the landscape in Europe significantly. I think a solution of these problems is only possible in cooperation with Russia, not without Russia. So if we wanted to go back to the version 2 of Cold War, then I think there would be no chance to solve any of these conflicts. On the contrary, global competition, regional proxy wars, and arm races are very, very likely. It is also important to remember that during the original Cold War, arms control helped to reestablish dialogue and to find stabilizing, verifiable, and robust limits and restraint for the most dangerous category of weapons to prevent a cataclysmic scenario of a nuclear exchange in Europe. It is quite clear that if Russia starts developing long-range systems, Europe would be the first target in principle, because it is quite easy to have short-range systems. That could be doable. But if you deploy long-range systems, you need superior space capabilities. And I think Russia has a lot of problems here to that. I think it must be evident for all of us that without including Russia in the long run in a comprehensive European security architecture, security in Europe is not achievable. And let me quote Moscow's or Ronald Reagan's ambassador in Moscow, Jack Matlock, who said recently it has been a very big mistake by Russia, by the EU, and most of all by the US to convert Ukraine politically to convert Ukraine political and economical reforms into an East-West struggle. So if we go that direction, then we all will be very much in trouble. So I think measures must be found to stop the spiraling up of the crisis and make further nuclear reductions again feasible. If we fail, then I think that would be a dramatic turn in world history, and we should really think carefully whether we wanted to go that way or that the way of cooperation is maybe the better alternative. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we've heard three presentations on some of the obstacles to further nuclear reductions. With regards to Gert's last comment, I prefer not to think in terms of failure as much as, you know, we may be ending, headed for a period of pause. And so the question is, can we then preserve enough so that when we get past this crisis that, in fact, we can move back down and get beginning to address some of the questions that are now on the arms control agenda. But I would like to pose one question to both Nikolai and Dennis. You both talked about the potential problems that long-range prompt global strike could provide for arms control. But when I try to be optimistic, it looks to me that, in fact, there may be some solutions to these problems if the sides were prepared to deal with them. In large part because I think you both indicated that you're talking about a niche capability. In part because, you know, building a system that can convey a conventional weapon 6,000 miles away is going to be expensive. And the sorts of targets that you might want to go after in that kind of time frame at that distance are probably not all that large. So it would seem to me that if you're talking about, for example, conventional ballistic missile warheads on intercontinental ballistic missiles and submarine-launched ballistic missiles, there already is an answer in the New START treaty, which makes no distinction between a nuclear warhead and a conventional warhead. If you begin to talk about something like hypersonic glide vehicles, which I think arguably, and the Defense Department said these would not be covered by New START, and I think that's probably correct when you look at the definitions of the treaty. However, if one side was looking at building 20 or 25 of these systems, you know, it would not be difficult, you know, basically to include them in the limits. So is prompt global strike something that, you know, if the sides go ahead, if they can in fact get past the technical challenges, that might be addressable by some of the arms control rules that are already in play?
You want to go first?
Okay, I can go first. well, That's a very good question. I think the answer, in fact, lies in the approach that was proposed by Obama administration after signing of New START. Yes, I fully agree with that. In fact, yes, I had written about that even 10 years earlier, about the need to shift the emphasis from delivery vehicles to warhead stockpiles. So when Obama talked about the need to address the stockpiles, strategic, non-strategic, deployed and non-deployed, that's one of the answers, like in my view, that's the preferable answer to what you really do with the conventional strike capability in terms of arms control. Because yes, perhaps these hypersonic glide vehicles will not be nuclear. But you could theoretically, in fact, just equip them with nuclear warheads. Plus, you also need to understand that the niche capability for the United States is different from the niche capability so when you talk about Russia. The interesting thing there is that the two countries have in mind roughly the same targets, or at least the targets that are in the same part of the world. It's all about Eurasia south of Russia. But for the United States, you actually need to strike from the other side of the world. And for Russia, it's in the neighborhood. So you actually need somewhat different systems. Plus, for the United States, there is a big challenge, as it was mentioned here, about equipping the good old strategic weapons like SLBMs with conventional warheads, simply because, like, if you launch them, they're bound to fly toward Russia or China. Russia does not have that challenge simply because they will not fly toward the United States. We actually, I was talking about the capability and not about the same systems. So the systems will be quite different, and really the only way to tell that a specific missile does not carry a nuclear warhead is to actually look at the stockpile and control the entire nuclear weapons stockpile so that you know exactly which delivery vehicles have nuclear warheads and which have conventional warheads. Yes, that's really the only way. Yes, that's the way forward. And let me just mention one small thing that I did not mention, and that's the INF Treaty. Yes, and Russia has been, well, the Russian military actually has talked about conventional intermediate range missiles for a long time. For the first time, in fact, they mentioned that in the year 2000, so it's like 14 years ago. So yes, that's theoretically nuclear-capable missiles. They want them for conventional missions, but once again, you really need kind of arms control tools to do something about that. Is the second option is really more about transparency, more like the Vienna document approaches. But it needs to go beyond the range of systems that covered, for example, by the CFE treaty. That's a long
Dennis?
I would, as a senior government official, share your concern about the lack of the U.S. government's ability to afford more than a niche capability. Mm-hmm. But God only knows what a future administration would do. Particularly, again, I would invite you to see my longer piece on this that talks about the prominence of these systems. And it just seems like a glide path forward for a country so fixated on missiles and, you know, and the kind of capability that that can be created. I've tried to bring some degree of sensibility to this by reminding people about the difference between a nuclear weapon and a conventional weapon. And nuclear weapons are very unforgiving. And the notion of, you know, assigning two to a particular strategic target, start thinking about a so-called precise conventional weapon with a rather small warhead, providing a similar capability to take out an important strategic target. It's going to take not just two, but many more. So, you know, niche starts growing as a byproduct of then the perceived recognition that you need a hell of a lot more of these systems. And, so that's there's a slippery slope that one ought to worry about when one thinks about these systems.
Okay. All right. Well, let me go ahead and open up the floor to questions. If you could identify name, affiliation, keep your question short, and please have a question mark at the end. Greg.
Greg Tillman, Arms Control Association. One of the categories of responses to Ukraine that you hear a lot in the U.S. and NATO is that the U.S. should respond in the missile defense sector, either accelerating the deployment of SM-3 systems to Europe or even reviving the Czech-Polish strategic system proposal that George Bush advanced. So I guess my question is, I'm assuming that the physics will not change that Gertz was referring to, that they would not be capable against Russian strategic systems. But the intention, it seems, would be radically different since both George W. Bush and Barack Obama have said consistently again and again that all of these missile defenses are oriented against missiles from the Middle East. Now, Russia says that they don't believe that. And I guess my question, Nikolai, is would this kind of action change anything, or would Russia just say, we told you so?
Well, of course, Russia will say, we told you so. That's quite obvious. Well, why not deploy, like, interceptors, like, in Poland? The big question is not whether we deploy like interceptors in Poland. The big question is whether these interceptors will intercept something. We keep forgetting that ultimately all the changes in the missile defense plans were really driven by technology. What was available? What can we actually do and what can we develop? The fourth stage of the phased adaptive approach was not canceled as a concession to Russia. It was canceled because the interceptor didn't work. That would be, I'm very sorry to say that, but that's a Russian response. Let's deploy something just because you don't like it. So I think it doesn't really make sense strategically. Same as the ideas to get rid of the three no's and deploy tactical nuclear weapons to the east. What can they change?
Yeah, no, I
quite
just...
frankly, nothing. Yeah. So. There is a difference between the psychological dimension of a response and the strategic dimension of the response. I don't exactly think that such proposals will do much in terms of containing Russia or deterring Russia or it's actually something. The bottom line there is very simple. Once again, you got the Baltic states that are very small that face this big Russia. If you look at the same thing from the Russian side, you do not see three small Baltic states. You see NATO as a whole. And you cannot change that perspective. You cannot change the fact that we used to talk about the security system from Vancouver to Vladivostok. Around the globe. It never materialized. Yes, and all these kind of things, they never really came to pass, and we're still there.
Yeah, Greg, I've actually expressed some degree of criticism about the idea of reviving the Bush missile defense plan, which seems to be problematic in two ways. First of all, the Czech government now says it would not accept the radar.
That's even, yes, that they wouldn't mention that. Yeah.
And second, with regards to the interceptors that would go into Poland, they would be based on the ground-based interceptors, which have now not had a successful test flight in 6 years.
Yes.
So, yeah, there are smart responses, there are unwise responses. I would put that in the latter category.
You bet.
Yes, and let me tell you that the Russians will probably be actually quite happy if we decide to deploy interceptors that don't work. Nice, simple. Yeah.
But they won't publicly admit that they don't work.
Yeah.
Bob Berg, Alliance for Peace Building. Thank you for this panel. I wonder, I'm sure we all agree that formal negotiations are certainly off the table now, but I'm wondering whether you see any possibilities for productive informal discussions to keep hypothetical ideas and solutions kind of churning around so that there is at least some continuing constituency for negotiations once they're permitted to be formal.
I can actually see it.
Okay. No? That's what this book's about.
Yes, I hope that, I'm not divulging like any secrets, but the Center for Nonproliferation Studies in Monterey, for which I work in Vienna, I work in Vienna, but the boss is in Monterey, we did actually track 1.5 meeting with the Russian MOD, yes, and Department of Defense / state here. We had the meeting in Switzerland in the middle of the crisis over Ukraine. So most official participation had to be canceled, of course. Like at the time when we planned the meeting, there was no crisis in Ukraine. but it was interesting how we received signals from both sides that they actually want the meeting to be held, and how the atmosphere at that meeting was considerably more constructive, in fact, than was the case in previous Track 1.5 meetings. About only 10% of time was spent on the familiar disagreements like missile defense, whatever, like things like that. People tended to kind of to mention that and I'll move to the next issue. So, yes, surprisingly, that very closed door, very kind of private meeting had quite a different, and I would say surprisingly positive tone to it. So, yes, I think there is a chance for very quiet, very closed-door meetings. I think that one of the sanctions that was imposed by the administration, that is to cancel the process of regular consultations, is probably not the best thing that was done. You need to keep kind of the dialogue going. You need to talk, even if you repeat the same position time and again for several years. That's what actually happened to test Ben talks in the late 50s and early 60s, and then suddenly, like in 63, we had that treaty. We can repeat that experience, I guess.
Gertz?
Yeah, I think, thank you very much for that question. We in Europe felt that it is already, by the way, 2 or 3 years ago that it is high time for these kind of informal discussions, and with the help of the German Ministry of Foreign Affairs, we created a trilateral group, which we called Deep Cut Commission. This group consists of 21 people from Russia, US, and from Germany. And the hope was that this group of experts, former decision makers, could make a difference here. Let me inform you that our partners, the Arms Control Association, will organize an event on that, I think, in 2 weeks, on 29th or 28th. 28th, in this room,
yes,
where we will present some of the results. I think that was an interesting attempt to bridge the gap. And on the other side, I'm not so much optimistic, actually, that these very concrete proposals really will be adopted under the current circumstances. Nevertheless, track 2 or track 1.5 is always important. But again, I'm wondering if Nikolai says, what can deployments change? Okay, fine, but and this costs a lot of money, and this creates new situations of uncertainty. And even in a crisis, this could be very dangerous. So I wonder that a experienced negotiator from the Cold War era is not seeing that we are on a slippery slope here, that the whole debate about future weapon systems would be also accelerated in the West. And, I mean, if you think we don't have the financial resources, I ask myself, what financial resources do the Russians have to invest in these kind of systems? So I have really some problems with that. That costs a lot of money. And if you speak about the Baltic states, if you look on a regional basis, then you will see that the Russian military has a 3-to-1 superiority in that region. And, I mean, of course, the Baltic states are getting nervous. So they will ask for more deployment of tactical nuclear weapons. In Britain, there's already debate whether they can afford to buy 2 more submarines or 4 submarines in the future. I mean, these voices will get a lot of stuff to make their points. And the question really is, do we want it to have that kind of arms competition again here? I doubt that this is a wise situation and a wise measure to do that. For me, as a physicist, you like to speak about the laws of physics and geography. I must confess here that I think it would be much better if we would have reasonable voices to sit together and to talk about how to stabilize Ukraine, for example, to see how to help that country. They have energy needs, and actually Russia is playing the role as energy as a weapon. So all the supporters which existed for a future open and cooperative strategies toward Russia are losing ground in Europe. And if this continues, we will back in at least Cold War 1.5. So I think we should not play so much with weapons and new technology developments. We should stick to the political problems which exist here. And I have the concern that President Putin has more or less lost this reasonable view how to stabilize countries. And, I mean, this is a concern which is now also emerging in the German audience. The Germans are very friendly to the Russians for many reasons, and there's a lot of understanding here about the lessons of the past, you know, the problems, the frustration. We owned Gorbachev a lot. So, in principle, there is a good, still a good a voice or supportive climate here. Angela Merkel speaks Russian, Vladimir Putin speaks German. But since 2 or 3 weeks, the chancellor said, I cannot reach any longer Mr. Putin. So I think it is high time to come back. There was a proposal to form a contact group and, you know, together with the Russians to decide about the Ukrainian future. I think the talks in Geneva will exactly try to do that, but one day, certainly after all these incidents, it is too short to find a long-lasting program how to solve the actual crisis. And nationalism is a concern from all sides, and I think it's not correct to say, you know, the Ukrainian government is not legitimized, and there are very right-wing groups getting power, and on the same time to fostering nationalists to take over police stations and so on and so on. So I think that's actually the problem, and I think that can only be solved if the 3 important entities, first the United States, second Russia, and the EU, will sit together. And I'm not sure whether the Geneva event, the Geneva talks will find a direct solution in the next days. But I hope, of course. Otherwise, again, we as Europeans have another big problem here.
I just want to say that I tried very purposefully to stay away from discussing the Ukrainian situation. That's a very complex situation that will take a long time to resolve. And although I very much disagree, to put it mildly, with the annexation of Crimea, I do think that I don't quite agree with your attitude, kind of your position as well, because fundamentally, the Russians do have this complaint that the right view, the correct view, is the one that's coming from the West. And Moscow should be wise. Moscow demonstrates wisdom when it agrees with the West. You actually mentioned Gorbachev, incidentally, and he supported annexation of Crimea. If you like Gorbachev, then you should actually accept that he might disagree with that wisdom as well. This is a highly complex situation. I think that the Russian behavior on Crimea was wrong. But the roots for a conflict were there. And that some conflict was inevitable. It could have happened a few years ago. Yes, it could have happened a few years later. It doesn't matter, but we were actually heading for it. So let's just not be surprised.
Steve Winters, Washington-based researcher. I'd like to ask about the missile defense or missile shield. And when I've heard top Russian leaders speak on this topic, what they say is, look, I'm not a military expert. I'm political leader. I'm this, I'm that. I'm following the advice of my military and their experts. This is their analysis of what's behind the missile shield and what the ultimate purpose is. So I can't really see that they have any other choice than to follow their own experts, except maybe fire them. So the question is, who do we have who is expert enough to actually counter the argument, if there is a counter to it, of these Russian military experts? It's a military matter. It would have to be somebody in our military. I don't see any discussion going on like that. So I think to just poo-poo the missile shield and say, oh, don't worry, the ICBMs can still reach America, that's not really the issue here. The issue is the Russian leaders don't have any choice. It's their responsibility to respond to their best experts in their military about what is perceived as a strategic threat in the next 10 years to their position.
I'm going to take one more question to give the panelists a chance to final wrap-up comments. Right.
Hello, I'm Steve Wallace. I recently retired from the Pentagon. I'd like to ask you a question regarding the political aspects relating to nuclear posture and policy reviews. Every time there's been a major change in this, it's led to some conflict and divisions within the alliance. Even if people later came to all accept it, this change in itself is disruptive to people. And I'm wondering, do you see any problems in that regard with regard to this global, the global strike issue? If we blur the distinction between weapons that were considered to be for deterrent purposes by associating the same kind of delivery systems with systems that are considered warfighting capabilities. Mm. And so what are the political problems inherent in blurring that distinction, which has always been kept distinct in the past?
Okay. Gertz, do you want to start?
BMD. I think that's a very good question, that the Russians sometimes argue that they haven't any choice. I have been invited for two conferences, the Moscow European Security Conferences, which were organized in 2012 and 2013. And I think the Russians have some valid points, but they also have their scientists. American and as well as European scientists made presentations on that occasion. And I think roughly the result of the simulation is if an interceptor it has a burnout velocity of more than 5.5 or 5 kilometers per second, then it could reach Russian intercontinental ballistic missiles heading to the United States. So I think the Russians should be aware on the laws of physics. I'm sorry. I have a lot of sympathy for the Russian view, especially if it comes to numbers, locations. And I think it's quite logical that the Russians saying we wanted to have legal guarantees. And the argument is that Congress and that politics cannot give these kind of legal guarantees. Unfortunately, the technology itself is very limited. If you look for the configuration of the radars, they are more or less oriented towards the Middle East. And the situation improved very much because of the cancellation of Phase 4. And when I was in Moscow on the same panel as Deputy Minister Antonov, I tried to bridge the gap and saying, this is a clear indication, whether it is technological or political, to come back to some kind of cooperation here. And the reaction of the military was very interesting. There were two generals, high-ranking generals, standing up. And the first said, it's good that the Americans gave up Phase 4. No, they have to give up Phase 3, and then phase two, and then Phase 1. Okay? I don't comment that. Then there was another general who stood up and said, please, Minister Antonov, explain our German friend what is the position of the Russian Federation about ballistic missile defense? And Mr. Antonov simply said, we communicated that to the Americans, which obviously means there is no position on that. So I must say, after really looking into a lot of technical and scientific simulations as well, but the Russians showed us also some of these simulations. This is, for me, as a physicist, purely ideological, and the leading figures simply wanted to are using it for playing again the old ABM, the old SDI card. And everyone who has a little bit knowledge about the technology knows that this is a big difference about the ambitions of SDI and the realities of ballistic missile defense. And they are simply ignored by the government. They might be irrational. I'm sure Nikolai will give you an explanation for that. But this is certainly very unpleasant for the Europeans because, we, in a sense, are the deployment states, and NATO is and has to do decisions about the future of that systems. And I fear, and I think Mr. Putin underestimated that very much, that NATO will show unity and they will make further decisions about expanding that kind of system.
Yeah, I don't think there was a factor.
Nikolai?
Okay. All right.
Short closing
well,
comment.
Well, now we actually learned that the Russians not only don't understand the national security, they also don't know physics.
No, the government.
Well,
they have very good scientists. Very good scientists.
Yes, but they don't have access to the government. All right.
Maybe,
all right.
Maybe this is the mistake.
Maybe. Yeah. And maybe you need to appoint physicists as president and things like that. No, I actually been to a number of meetings as well. In fact, to some meetings that were less public, I'm afraid. The discussion on the technical side was actually quite interesting. Yes, when the Russians showed Americans these simulations that you referred to, in fact, the full simulation and not the cut-down version that they presented at that big conference in Moscow, the American response was, well, you factored in the assumptions about the specs that are inflated. We cannot do these things that you assume that interceptors can do. Yes, and the Russians said, okay, tell us the real specs. The Americans said, well, Oh, it's classified. No? So yes, I think that the laws of physics actually work the same way, like in Russia, as in the United States, like, or in Europe, and everyone knows the laws of physics. Well, it's more about the technology is in the exact specs. So that's one problem. The second problem is, well, it's not about the current plans, let's be frank. Well, if I understand the Russian position correctly, they can not only accept the current plans. Well, in fact, well, judging kind of from more kind of confidential conversations, they can accept the limits to missile defense that are roughly double what we currently plan. But they want these limits. So it's like a morally matter of principle. So what we actually have is not technology, not even the laws of physics. It's the domestic politics on both sides, because in this city you cannot discuss limits. That's it. It's not about technology and physics. It's on the Russian side. Well, that theoretical threat from missile defense might actually take like 10 years to emerge, maybe longer, but they prefer to talk like in ways that the threat is immediate. So yes, absolutely, you got political domestic politics on both sides, and yes, and that's the big challenge. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, final word.
I'll try to address the question about the posture review and in the context of conventional prompt global strike. I think, frankly, the 2010 posture review, it seemed to me, was talking not about conventional prompt global strike, but about the across the board improvements that have been made in precision strike systems. And certainly this message resonated in certain circles in Russia, because when you talk to them behind the scenes, they are frankly less concerned about conventional prompt global strike and more concerned about this array of different precision strike capabilities that can be brought to bear.
Yep.
I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. The prospect for conventional prompt global strike to, again, as I mentioned before, turn into something quite different with a different characteristic associated with it, notwithstanding its expense problems, is something two to worry about. And last, on the issue of what the Russians really, or how they deal with the issue of current missile defense interceptors, it just strikes me, it's patently clear, what they're concerned about is there's no damn ABM treaty to provide a set of constraints for the future. Mm-hmm. And that's what they worry about, a future administration that, goes full speed ahead.
Things can change, yes.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay, good. Well, I think this panel did what we hoped it would do, was to discuss both political and technical challenges that are hindering nuclear reductions. I try to be an optimist. I still think that there is a future for arms control, but I think that, what we've heard today is that there are some issues that have to be overcome if we want to get back on that track to further reducing the nuclear danger. But please join me in thanking the panel for the discussion.